Welcome to Infinite Returns, Commercial Real Estate Investing, brought to you by Infinity Commercial Capital. We help people find money. We are investors, lenders, and financing advisors. And this podcast is about real estate investing and helping you. Whether it's investing in residential rental properties or commercial properties, we talk about lending and all things real estate. From newbie to experienced, from funding to the strategy it takes to find success. Welcome your host, Carl Baker.
Well, welcome to the show, Infinite Returns, a show about commercial real estate investing. I'm happy to have you here today. My name's Carl Baker, a 30-year CPA, a real estate investor, business owner, and the CEO of Infinity Commercial Capital, the show's sponsor. We help people find money. More about our show later. Don't forget to subscribe or like the show so that you see the content, as we produce more shows and looking at the back at prior shows. Today, I'm very excited to introduce our guest, Mike Kading, CEO of Norhart for the past 15 years. He's been working at Norhart, designing, building, renting apartments with a focus to drive down the cost of housing, which here's a hint, that's what we're going to talk about today. But hello, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. And at the end, we like to talk about things that we care about personally. So tell us what your favorite cause is as well as you introduce yourself.
Yeah. Well, at a really high level, just as a company first, we design, build, and rent apartments, but we're focused on driving down the cost of housing. We've been achieving about a 20 to 30% reduction in those construction costs, and we believe that over time, we can achieve a 50% reduction. But imagine what that means. That means someday your rent or your mortgage payment could be half. And that's really our dream as a company. You know, for me, I grew up with this. My parents originally started the business. In fact, growing up, we lost everything. And my parents, or my dad, was actually kidnapped in Peru. But as I grew up and went off to college, the one thing that I knew for certain is that I wanted nothing to do with the family business. And the reason that was is that deep down, I don't want people to think it was given to me. So I really wrestled with my own ego for quite a while. But what I realized more than anything else is that I wanted to make some kind of meaningful, positive impact in the world. So I jumped in full throttle, worked with my dad for a few years, and then unexpectedly, he passed away. Suddenly, we didn't see it coming. And basically, overnight, I became CEO of the organization. And then since then, we've grown substantially. And as you talk about causes, I think there's some easy causes I could talk about. For example, the Salvation Army. We're actually partnered with them right now in raising food and support for a local community. And we're doing this thing on the on local TV tomorrow, actually. But I think what's deeper than that is any one cause for me is that I just want to meaningfully solve some significant issue in society. And I think in the long term, the best I can do for society is by driving down those costs of housing. If we can do that in a meaningful way, I think I'll be very happy with solving that as a major cause in our lives.
Yeah. In other words, you are a cause unto yourself in terms of giving back. So what an impactful comment there. So that's fantastic. Well, thank you for that introduction. And I think the audience and I personally can start to see why I'm looking forward to this conversation. So, why don't you talk at whatever level you want to in terms of where your geographic footprint is, what your housing footprint looks like, and then segue that into talking about high level approach to driving down costs. Because obviously that would be very meaningful to your local community. And just, I'm interested in learning more about that.
Yeah. So today we have about 1,000 units under management. We're producing about 300 to 400 units per year. And we're primarily just in the state of Minnesota, although we do have some manufacturing capabilities in Wisconsin, and we've got about 15% of our staff is actually international all over the world. So how do we actually solve construction costs? Well, at a really simple level, if you look at other industries like manufacturing, they've improved labor productivity by 760% over the past 60 years. Construction during that same time period has done nothing, or, well, 10%, but basically nothing. And so really all we're doing is we're taking the lessons learned from these other industries and applying it into our own. The first example I'll give is in the world of construction, it's very segmented. You have a different company that's your plumber, a different company that's your HVAC, a different company electrician, and so forth. Uh-huh. Imagine if a construction company were to produce cars. You'd have a different person, a different company installing the windshield, a different company installing the door, and a different company installing the wheel.
Right.
And of course, the wheel company, they would call you up and say, "Hey, I'm so sorry. We got delayed on another project and we can't get out there for 2 weeks." Well, your line would be shut down. And see, the world of manufacturing looks at us and says, "You're crazy." And see, our response in the construction industry is, "This is the way it's always been done." But that's not good enough. So one of the first things we did was we brought all of that work under one roof. So our plumbers, electricians, HVAC, they're all our own staff. We do precast concrete, wall panel manufacturing, engineering and architecture, supply chain and logistics. We've literally brought all of that under one place. But once we do that, it starts unlocking new opportunities. And one revolutionary technique that we can steal from the manufacturing industry is the assembly line. I know, okay, maybe not that revolutionary, but how the heck could you take a building and drive it down a line? Well, you can't. It's too big. But what you can do is you can take the person and move them through the building. Mm-hmm. So right now, our teams shift through the building about every 5 hours by one unit. And so if you look at the end of our building, every 5 hours, we have a brand new apartment unit completed. In fact, the other end of the building, it's just dirt. That's how like compact this work is. And that one technique can take a project that might take 15 months and drive it down to 9. But overall, there's 10,000 little things that when they come together, they have a meaningful impact on cost.
Wow. Fantastic. So let me ask you a question. It's what you said. I'm sure you get a lot of surprised reactions when you explain your business model. And the surprise that I have is not because I'm contrarian about it. It makes so much sense. You and I didn't talk about this in advance. So I'm listening to this and hearing this for the first time too, which is good because my reactions are true. Tell me why does, I have to confess, I don't know the answer to this. Why does the general contractor construction business operate in such a fragmented, siloed format? And why is there resistance to this? I mean, I can guess on some of those things, but why is what you're describing so revolutionary?
Yeah, it's... Well, one, it's very hard to do. And anytime you do something new, like going from framing into plumbing, like you're going to get worse at it before you get better, right? And so you'll actually perform poorly. You'll be more expensive. It'll be harder to get through. And there's this initial curve that you've got to be comfortable with failure and getting through that.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't want to go through that. They found their niche, their little like world, their fiefdom, like, this is the way it's always done by other people. And it's the way we're doing it. And it just feels good. We're making good profit. There's no reason to change it. Another big issue is when you bring all that work under one roof, you need a consistent demand for your product. And so most properties, most communities that are built, there's a developer that goes and finds the land, kind of negotiates all their entitlements, gets approval. And that might be years to get through that process. And then now they go and look for a contractor to go build it for them. Mm-hmm. But just because of that very nature, it's kind of spotty up and down here and there demand. And that developer certainly doesn't want to build up a whole construction infrastructure just to be able to build their one building. And so because of that, there isn't really a natural path forward unless you're willing to lay the foundation for the entire thing. Mm. And we started at that developer, general contractor level, which gave us that consistent demand that we needed. The last thing that I would mention is that there are industries like maybe software development or AI or banking that tend to attract the brightest minds of our generation. Construction certainly has some incredible thought leaders mm-hmm. and thinkers to solve problems. Mm-hmm. But I would say in general, construction doesn't attract those bright minds in the same way that AI attracts those great minds. And so there are a number of people in the construction industry that have kind of an older thought process, maybe a rough and tumble kind of existence, and they don't want to change. They don't want to think about new innovation. That's just not how they're wired. And so one thing that we've really worked hard to do is to build out a team of people that are at that exceptional level. Mm. In fact, our acceptance rate into our company for staff and construction is 0.4%, which is way, way, way better than any other contractor that I know out there.
Wait a minute. Explain that. Your acceptance rate into your hiring?
Yes.
Is 0.4%?
Yes.
So that means that for every 100 applicants, you're hiring half of one. Am I following that?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
There's about, for every 200 people that want to work here, we only hire one.
Wow.
And that was one of probably the biggest game changers to really improving this infrastructure mm-hmm. is realizing the importance of that. I can touch more on that if you like.
Yeah, that is a very stringent, to me, that sounds like a very stringent hiring process, which, you know, good for you. With the notion in the world that hiring is difficult, that finding good help is hard to find, finding warm bodies, finding help, period, is hard to find. And yet you're maintaining a standard of hiring the right people for the bus, even if it makes it more difficult to find those people.
That's right. You know, this taps into the most important lesson that I've ever learned. And that is to hire the very best. Mm-hmm. And when I say the best, I truly mean the best. We have employees that we will fly in from other states to come work during the week and then fly them home on the weekend. Mm. We have one staff member that in 2007, Steve Jobs announces the brand new iPhone. Steve Jobs walks off that stage and our employee walks on that same stage following Steve Jobs' announcement. Mm. And see, the thing that I've learned is that those level of people, they change things. They unlock doors for you that you didn't know could be unlocked. They make the world better. And at this point, many people look at me, including my older self, and say, Mike, that sounds expensive. And if you look at it on a cost per person basis, that's true. You have to pay them top of market. You have to give them the best in the world, Google-like benefits. Mm-hmm. But what most people fail to understand is that the best people outperform the average by 2 to 5 to even 10 times as much. Mm-hmm. So instead of looking at it as a cost per person, you should really look at it as a cost per unit produced. If you look at it from that perspective, your best people are actually your least expensive. And this changed everything for us.
It makes a lot of sense. Before I forget, and not at all to change the subject, but just to add some perspective, you're building these apartment complexes and housing units. Are you building them for sale, or are you building them for your own portfolio growth? Just because then it from that, I have some follow-up questions as we talked about the other things that you've mentioned, some of the process approach.
Yeah, we typically build to hold, but we do occasionally sell. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So yeah, you're building your properties and then also managing the housing. So with that, again, it makes so much sense because you're essentially building a vertical operation, and manufacturers have figured that out. Retail and distributor organizations have figured out how to put together the vertical infrastructure. What you're essentially doing is removing the individual fragmented profit motivation with each individual component, consolidating all of that, having one profit motive within that, and eliminating the necessary costs baked into that. So it makes a ton of sense. You mentioned when you introduced the concept of reducing costs, you talked about the vertical integration of the various disciplines, but you also talked about the assembly line. So talk about, and maybe we'd each have a different way to do it, but talk about the way a normal situation would be set up, and then the way you would do it on a little bit micro basis. So if you've got an apartment complex, let's just say you've got the main floor and you're building the first floor, you're framing the first floor. And how would a traditional construction process look compared to how yours would look? You touched on it, but just a little bit more detail on that, because I think that's fascinating.
Yeah. So let's imagine that the framers come in to frame up the wood structure of the building. Mm. The framers will do first floor and the entire floor, then climb to second floor, third floor, fourth floor, and go up from there. And then maybe by the time they got to second or third floor of the entire building, you'd have the plumbers come in and they would start drilling their holes, laying their pipe down. But during that time, what you start realizing is there's large swaths of the building that nothing is happening, right? So the plumbers may only be drilling holes in the first unit, but there's an entire floor of framing that's been completed that no one's working on. Mm-hmm. And then once the plumbers get through their stuff, then the electricians maybe follow that. Where we're different is the framers come in and frame the first unit. They then go to the second unit, and the plumbers are right there behind them plumbing the first unit. So there is no space that's not being worked on at any one time. One of my favorite examples that show the challenges you face with just subcontractors is drywallers. They're notorious for wanting large areas cleared out because they're focused on optimizing their own profitability, as is everyone. And if anything's in the way, if things are not clear, if there's any risk of them not being able to continue their work efficiently through that project, they don't want to be out there yet. So they want to see that entire area clear. But that then necessitates large swaths of the building, again, not being worked on. And because of that, it creates waste in the schedule that can be reduced if you think about it more like a one-piece flow. Mm.
That is fascinating. So we could dive into more details of that, but talk about what has been the impact, because let's talk about the results. What has been the impact on the units that you have developed? I'm assuming, of course, you have a major cost savings and you're able to share that savings with the market. So talk about how that has gone for you. As people are listening to this, yeah, they're going to, I would hope that somebody's going to say, we need to figure this out too. So what's been your results? How has this translated?
Yeah. So we very regularly see about a 20 to 30% reduction in construction costs compared to other developers building very similar buildings. You know, we think with time we can get to a 50% reduction. One of the immediate benefits, just from a development standpoint, is in normal, or I should say the last couple of decades of banking environments, banks would typically lend about 75% of the cost of the product. Mm-hmm. And so when our costs, 75% of the value of the project, when our costs are only 75% of that value because we've reduced the construction cost, we can typically get banks to fund the entire project. Mm. Now, there is, for the sophisticated listeners out there, there are rules, there's HVCRE rules and stuff that you have to navigate around. But principally, there are ways to navigate around that correctly, and your overall investment in the project is virtually nothing. Mm. And this is how you get to true infinite returns, because again, our construction costs are low enough. You don't really need equity in the deal. And when we look at our IRRs, in many cases, they're infinite. They're nonsensical because of that arrangement. So financially, that's how it benefits. But the more important question you tapped on is, how does it impact the market? Mm-hmm. And probably the most pointed question I often get is, Mike, you talk about solving housing affordability, but when I go onto your website, your rents are about the same as everyone else. What the heck is going on? The answer is this. We could lower our rents today for the, you know, few thousand people that we serve, and we would certainly have solved housing affordability for them. But that's not really our ultimate goal. Our ultimate goal is to solve housing affordability nationwide. Well, how do you do that? Well, really, we're taking those profits and putting them back into the system that builds that housing. Yeah. Think about that manufacturing infrastructure. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cost and energy and effort to really build out that system. You know, Elon Musk talks about how it's hard to produce a car, but it is 10 to 100 to 1,000 times harder to produce the system that builds that car. So we're pouring the money into that system. And over the next decade or so, our dream is to reach 192,000 units under management with a 60,000 unit per year pace. At that kind of level, we're producing so many units in the markets that we serve that abundance of supply starts driving down the price. And here's the key. It's not just for our own residents. It's for everyone within those markets that we're serving.
Right, you're starting to make a meaningful impact in your existing markets, and impacting the, more than likely, you're going to impact the way the broader construction market does business as you gain share and visibility, and you wouldn't necessarily be the only company building housing the way you're doing it. So I'm assuming that's part of what you're meaning by all of that.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's fantastic. So talk about, and I certainly get, and a lot of people that are the advanced listeners will get your concept of the infinite returns, because you're able to obtain financing that covers 100% of the cost. But generally, when we talk about obtaining financing, we talk about the financing structure being some percentage of the cost of the building capped by the future value of the building. And when real estate investors talk about a return on investment, they talk not just about the total project cost or the total value, but the total cash on cash return. In other words, the sponsor's actual cash out of pocket, the initial equity infusion into the cost basis. And what you're saying, Mike, is that at the end of the day, on these major construction projects, because people do what you talk about on little flip projects, single family homes all the time, they're hoping to get infinite returns in the BRRRR method. But to do that on a multifamily complex situation is materially different and very impactful. That's what the infinite return means.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know anyone else who's been able to do it with multifamily.
Right.
The one of the big challenges, to get in the weeds a little bit, that you face is that banks have LTV requirements, mm-hmm. but loan to value, mm-hmm. but also LTC requirements or loan to cost. Mm-hmm. And typically they won't go beyond 75% loan to cost, right. as well. But the way you can work with that is a few different factors. One is you can introduce deferred developer fees. It's a way to increase the costs very reasonably without having to put in the equity. But the more interesting one that we've been working through is once you start to own all the subcontracting entities, mm-hmm. the banks will, we're very transparent with the banks. We tell them all of this. The banks will allow us to take fair market pricing on those subcontractor entities. So if the plumber would normally bill $100,000 for something and it only costs us $80,000, we can bill ourselves $100,000. Now, what that enables us is we can take that profit then during the construction phase. So we actually do have to bring equity to the table, but we get to pull that equity out while the project is going along through the profits at the subcontractor level.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you just, again, like you said, to get in the weeds a little bit, you own the entire vertical process. You own all the plumbers, all the electricians, but are you meaning that you set them up as individual sub entities and you're doing intercompany billing for the individual disciplines? Right. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So yeah, you're right. Normally, there is no allowance for intercompany billing, to drive up cost basis, but I can certainly see why a lender that gets to know you and gets to know your real value, they can afford to give a higher cost basis in their loan because they know it's not really a gimmick. There's real cost savings in there. So,
yeah. And what's particularly interesting, because our costs are so low, our bigger issue with banks is actually that they don't like that the cost of the building is so low, because they're concerned that if it really is that low and we walk, that they don't have enough money in the deal to get someone else to come finish it. So there's a bit of the bank actually kind of likes the fact that they were increasing the costs and then making it all work that way.
Right. A lender wants to understand that there is some equity in the project by the investor, by the sponsor. And they are only they're only comfortable if that equity is there. Another way I say it is the lender kind of stays behind the project in the financing, and not get too far out ahead of the sponsor's cost investment. So, but I could certainly, again, I can certainly see why it's why there's benefit to thinking differently, because you're thinking differently and you're asking the lenders to think differently as well. Fantastic. So anything else? We've talked about your different approach. We've talked about the impact of that different approach. We've talked about your future goals. Fantastic. And I'll look forward to following how this goes in the coming years. One of the things that you said is, well, let me just ask, how has, as you've talked about relationships with lenders, with banks, et cetera, how has that relationship been as interest rates are changing? How have rental rates been? Just talk about the economy and what you're seeing in the market.
Yeah, I would say on the rental side, things have been good and strong. We've just nationwide, we've seen large increases in rents over the last a couple of years, maybe not so much recently, but a year or so ago, which has been very helpful to increasing values and just cash flows. The biggest challenge, so we're always faced with new big challenges, but the big challenge that we're faced with, and a lot of developers are faced with right now, is the fact we've got a rising or a interest rate environment that's higher than it has been in the past. Mm-hmm. And because of that, getting a little bit technical, we're typically hitting debt service coverage ratio requirements, where in the past it was all LTV requirements. Mm-hmm. What this means effectively is that banks are no longer providing as much money as they once did. Before, they were providing about 75% of a project, and I've seen it get as low as 55% of a project in recent times. And so because of that, you know, our costs aren't 45% less. Because of that, we've been having to pivot and learn how to raise additional capital to fill that sort of middle tier gap in financing. Now, what's really challenging in the market is that we're seeing new multifamily starts drop by as much as 70% over the past year. Mm-hmm. Because everyone's faced with very similar economic challenges at the moment. In fact, I heard this from a non-verified source, so take it with a grain of salt, that even like Graystar right now is completely pencils down on all new development, which is mind-blowing how big they are. So we're always looking for innovative approaches to solve these issues. And one of the things that we did last year was look to raise capital. So we ended up launching a fund to retail investors that has been successful. And then we've also now been working and learning about international fundraising as well. Mm. Been very interesting paths that we've been discovering and learning more about that have enabled us to kind of get and bridge that gap. But that's the problem we're faced with this year. There'll be a new problem next year, and you always have to cancel it. Wrestle with those and work your way through.
Well, what I'm hearing from that is you have problems and you're, instead of wallowing in those problems, you're looking for solutions. And you know, probably what, 2 years ago, you didn't necessarily, I don't know how many years ago, but at some point in the recent past, you did not know how to raise capital the way you do now, and you've taken that on to solve your corporate problem.
Exactly. Yeah. Even a year or year to 2 years ago, we never raised capital ever. And so it's a whole new skill set that we've been having to learn. But wow. That's life.
Yeah.
That makes life fun.
That makes it pretty exciting. Well, I'm excited for you. I'm interested in all the things you've learned. So I do want to ask, it's because you brought up a subject in our planning about a new FTC rule and junk fees. I'm assuming you're wanting to raise awareness about this proposed legislation. And so I'd like for you to just explain that and talk about that.
Yeah, so the FTC is proposing a new rule that would ban all junk fees. These are fees that get tacked on top of the advertised price you see online. Now, there's two exceptions for this. There's your shipping fees and your taxes, but all other fees will be banned. And in general, I'm actually excited about this. There's many markets, like when you buy tickets and they're 50% more than the price you see online,
yes,
that will get banned. Or hotels. It drives me nuts that a hotel will charge you a base fee, but then they'll charge you a resort fee on top of that.
Yes.
In the world of apartments, the major institution or the major groups that support apartments are actually against this rule. They want to exempt apartments from it. And I just think that's wrong. The apartment market is also one where I have seen it become a race to the bottom, where people have added on more and more crazy fees. There's certainly reasonable fees, I would say, like utility submetering. But when you get to stuff like your garbage collection being charged on top of things, amenity fees I've seen. There was one community I saw that charged a January fee simply because it was January. I saw a study recently that showed that a number of properties are charging like an additional 30% on top of their rent for these mandatory fees that get added on later. And so I just think, it's not something that I think is right. We try not to do that stuff, but it's hard to not do it if your competitors are doing it because you lose market share to them. And so I think it's a good thing for the overall market for a rule like this to get passed so that we're all on an even playing field sharing a very similar like price or what that price means. Mm-hmm.
Make it apples to apples. Sure. Wow. Well, I think as general consumers, from a consumer perspective, we're all usually annoyed at all those little junk fees. So, it's interesting. I had seen that. I have to admit, I'd seen that ban, now that you elaborated on it, on a broader basis. I hadn't thought about the impact that that ban would have on the rental property unit. So that's a fascinating thing. Thank you for raising awareness on that. And again, you're taking an honest approach to the legislation and the proposal instead of just advocating on behalf of the industry the way everybody else thinks about it. What's the right way to do this? So I really like the way that happened, the way you're approaching that. Well, very good. Thank you for that, Mike. I just wanted to highlight, as you may have seen if you're watching this on video, where I'm looking away, and I've been taking a few notes because I think some of the things that Mike has been talking about is fascinating. So I just want to highlight a few things that we've talked about. Mike is trying to change the world in terms of the way contractors are running their business. And I just think that's fascinating. I can't wait for this message for me to do my teeny weeny little part to advance that message. And I hope other people catch on. So I'll be rooting for you. I think it's fascinating that in this world of labor shortages, you are maintaining your standards of finding the best people. And what a lesson there for all of us as we're hiring people. I've certainly hired people before, and I've made mistakes in the way I've hired people. And just listening to you talk about it just causes me to double down on my thought process on that. So thank you, Mike, for that. And again, just the housing comments, I really look forward to the impact that you're going to have in the market on housing. So thank you for that. Any other comments from you? What's a final piece of advice for you and a final comment that you would like to make, Mike?
Yeah, you know, I think maybe the most important lesson to take away is not necessarily all the details of how this stuff works, which is certainly interesting. Mm-hmm. But what I've learned is that at every step in the process, you're doing something new. And that new thing is going to be incredibly hard. In fact, anytime we start something new, we're going to be terrible at it. And as kids, we're okay with that. But as we grow to be adults, we're nervous about that. We think that we should show a better side of ourselves, that failure shouldn't be something that's tied on our resume. But in order to change an industry, it requires a degree of failure, because that failure comes with trying and learning something new. So my encouragement to you is to not be afraid of that failure, to step into that and just to be okay with it, because that's the only way truly forward.
Well, that's fantastic. How can, I have it in front of me here, but how can people get in touch with you and your company if they want to learn more about what you're doing?
Yeah, the best way is to visit our website. That's norhart.com. It's norhart.com. And one fun thing on there is our own podcast called Zero to Unicorn. It's about the journey of small business growing to $1 billion scale. It's about people really, truly making an impact.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you. I will make sure I follow that. And we'll put the website in the show notes if you're watching this on video, and in the notes. So we'll make sure that that gets out there. Well, thank you very much, Mike. I have very much enjoyed the conversation. I'd like to just now transition into talking about Infinity Commercial Capital, the show's sponsor. We help people find money. We are financing advisors helping people in the commercial real estate space, whether that is true commercial properties or whether that is residential investment properties. We're helping people find financings. One difference that we have is that we actually represent the borrower to seek the capital solution that is best aligned with your needs. And that's one of our value propositions. We sort of specialize in the 30-year fixed rate commercial loan, but other types of financing that we have available include bridge loans, construction loans. We tend to work with the asset-based underwriters that are looking at the subject property and less about the sponsor's personal financial situation. So there are lots of lenders out there, and our job is to align your scenario with the lender's appetite. So we look forward to that. You can email us at Infinity, or find us on the website on the web at Infinitycom Capital. Call us at 314-403-7745. You can email us at info@infinitycomcapital. You can find us all over the place on social media. We're doing our best to add education, not just simple advertising, where our followers can just be educated about real estate and financing. As we wrap up again, make sure that you like and follow the show. Thank you very much. One last time, thank you to Mike, our guest. It's been a fantastic discussion. I've really enjoyed it and learned a lot. If you have questions about any of this, make sure that you leave a comment. If you want to be on the show, if you have ideas, please make sure that you leave those comments, and we will get back with you on that, including if you have questions for Mike, we'll make sure that we get those to you. Thank you for watching and listening. We'll be looking forward to future shows, and thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Questions, comments, want to be a guest? You can reach Carl at kbaker@infinitycomcapital.com. You can find all episodes of Infinite Returns Commercial Real Estate Investing on all major podcast platforms and YouTube. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, happy investing.